You're listening to the Advancing Your Photography podcast. I'm your host, Mark Silber. I connect you with remarkable photographers who've mastered their craft, sharing their insight and skills so you can put them right to use. We have a special episode, and it is brought to you by our friends at DxO who make the Nik 3 collection. It's a famous plug-in suite. You're going to learn all about it today, later in the show. Now, if you've read my book, Advancing Your Photography, you know that I'm a fan of the Nik collection. I've been using it for years. DxO, who makes the Nik collection, has a special offer we're going to provide you so you can dive right in after the show. Now, we have a really special guest. His name is Dotan Segui. He was born in Israel, grew up in Paris, immigrated to New York City in the mid-1990s, and has been calling Los Angeles his home since then for 20 years. And you'll see that he's really gotten into the fabric of that city, and he's got a really interesting collection of photographs. In 2015, Dotan decided to focus on his lifelong passion for photography, after he already had a successful high-tech career. And since then, his photographs have been published in many major publications. He's been teaching workshops for Leica. As you know, I'm a huge fan. He's published 2 books and has become an ambassador for DxO Labs, again, the makers of the Nik collection. And Dotan, it is so awesome to have you with us on Advancing Your Photography. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark. It's such an honor to be with you today.
Well, we're going to learn a lot, because one of the things we're going to talk about is something that I consider extremely important, and a lot of our viewers do too, which is how to make really outstanding black and white images that pop. You know, it's a lot more than just adjusting the saturation slider there. You know, you really have to develop these images. So we're going to pick your brains and watch your workflow. I'm really excited about that. But first of all, I want to ask you what I always begin with, which is, what is it that drives you when it comes to photography?
Well, what drives me is the moment. That's really, if there's the one word. I'm a big Cartier-Bresson fan in terms of, you know, that school of thought that everything is driven by the moment.
Yeah.
And so that's what drives me, is I just hunt for these moments. And I've, you know, developed over time a technique and a methodology to try to, you know, have the best chances of finding them and then capturing them.
So, well, let's talk about it. I have your screen open here to this amazing picture of the young child with the snake. There's a lot going on in this image. Guys, absolutely. With, doing some exercise stuff. Tell us what's going on. And you do have a moment here for sure. There's obviously a lot happening that you kind of orchestrated all at once, it looks like.
Yeah. So, I mean, and that's a moment is really what I'm looking for, but juxtaposed moments is like the holy grail for me. And I adore the work of, you know, people like Alex Webb for that reason, is that ability to capture juxtaposed moments. Yeah. It's a tough thing to do, but when you do it, it's just such a high to be able to get that and to kind of immortalize those scenes that have a lot of components to them. And like you said, there's a lot to look at. And that's really what I strive for in a picture, is to provide not just a little snack to people, but really a whole meal. Yeah. Where you can go around and around and the eye can just kind of get lost in that picture and never get tired of looking at it.
So it's something we've talked about before with past guests, is that you have essentially many photographs within one photograph.
Exactly. I mean, that's really the goal, you know, that's the ultimate goal for the kind of photography that I like doing. In this particular scene, so this is shot at Venice Beach in L.A.
Right.
And it was an interesting moment that I stumbled upon when I first started this Venice Beach project, which culminated in the book a couple years later, 3 years later. But when I first discovered this scene, this is actually about an hour into the scene. I stayed with it for quite some time because there was just so much going on there.
Yeah.
But what was happening is this surreal moment that, you know, it's kind of the only in Venice kind of thing, where you had this mom and her child with those two giant boas and just playing with them in the sand. And
I didn't even see the other one. Right. Yep.
Yeah. There's another one that's kind of like going like it's in the sand going towards that woman on the sand who's actually the mom.
Okay.
And she's in this, I can just show quickly. This is her.
Oh,
and
wow.
She's on the cover of a book called Venice Beach. And so this is actually, this image was maybe 5 minutes or less into the scene, you know, once I stumbled upon it. And then the second image is about maybe 45 minutes later. But essentially what they were doing, the two of them were, they were snake sitting for a street performer who was on break. And actually in this particular image, you can see the street performer coming back. He was actually walking back from his break. It's the guy all the way to the left with the cross hanging.
Okay.
And I actually didn't know he was the owner at that point because he was just coming back and I had not seen him before. So they were, for that whole 45 minute, you know, thing, they were basically snake sitting those snakes. And I engaged in conversation with her from the beginning because sometimes I like to shoot things completely candid where people don't even know I'm there. But in cases like this, where I know I'm going to have to spend the time to really capture the high moments, there is no alternative to introducing yourself because otherwise it gets weird very, very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, all speech photographers out there know exactly what I'm talking about. So you have the choice of, do you stay invisible or try to stay invisible, or do you just, you know, completely engage with the subject and reveal yourself? The tough thing is once you revealed yourself to make yourself invisible again, like to have them just not care about you so that it can become candid again. So this was a situation where I knew I had to establish that first contact, build the trust, and then, you know, be that fly on the wall.
Yeah.
And so that's how pictures came about.
Let me ask you about that, because that's come up. So first of all, what's the decision whether or not to become invisible or not? What point do you decide, okay, I better introduce myself?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I don't want to jump the gun here, but I teach this class on street photography. It's an online masterclass that
cool.
we'll talk about later. This is one aspect that's one of the things that are really important in this, you know, in learning about street photography is there's those different modes that you can go into depending on the situation.
Right.
And as a street photographer, I think it's more productive to be aware of all these modes, of all these, you know, things that you can do so that you can consciously adopt one or the other based on the situation. And so your question about when, you know, how you make the decision whether to stay invisible or not, that's a really important one. And it's, you know, my preference is to remain invisible, but the exceptions are when I feel like there's I really need to wait in order to get the moment.
Yeah.
If the moment is not happening right in front of me and it's not a peak moment right away, but I see that there's potential, then typically maybe I'll try to stay invisible for a couple more minutes. But then when I see that that the subject has noticed me, or, you know, it's unavoidable in order to get that moment I have to introduce myself. Then I do that. Sometimes not even with the camera, like I'll put the camera back in the bag or I'll keep it, you know, kind of down, and I don't want to be, perceived as any kind of, you know, I don't want to intimidate the subject. I really want to befriend them and make them comfortable with my presence. And then if I feel like they're comfortable enough, then I'll say, is it okay for me to stay here and take some candid shots? Just ignore me, pretend I'm not there. You know, pretend I'm invisible. And if that's okay with you, I'll take a few pictures and I'm happy to share them, you know, after I'm done. You know, this might be some great moments that you can remember later. So most cases, people really appreciate that,
yeah.
Especially if it's like a scene like this. Jenna, who was the name of the mom, and Jackson is the name of the child. They were thrilled that I was capturing those moments because they were very special moments for them as well. And they weren't, you know, they were pretty sure that nobody was going to be there to witness them or document them. So for me to be there and be able to take those photos, they were thrilled to let me stay there and be that fly on the wall.
I love it.
Which is been the case, you know.
So, really good advice too about, you know, basically, I mean, that's the first time I've heard this is, you know, these different modes that you can be in. I think that's, and that's something we can all practice and go, okay, I'm moving from stealth mode to I'm going to reveal myself, you know, and you kind of consciously think that.
Right.
That's
right.
Really good advice. Let's see some more in this series.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to give you a little bit of background behind the advice, I come, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction, I come from a business and take high tech background.
Yeah.
And so the way I was trained, you know, I was a computer science major and so on. I have a master's in computer science. My brain works in a way that, you know, everything can be dissected into some sort of methodology. And when I've been in the photo world, you know, for a long, long time, as, you know, just as a hobby. But I've always, you know, and I've always kind of looked for advice from, you know, the master photographers, street documentary photographers, photojournalists, about how to go, you know, what is the methodology? How do you do it? And by and large, I think the consensus when you hear what they have to say is, you know, a little fuzzy in terms of, oh, you know it when you see it, or you just have to practice a lot and it will come to you. And I was just so frustrated by that because I felt like there has to be more to it in terms of a process that you can follow in order to get good results. And that's what I've been trying to distill. Basically, I've been trying to like take my own experience and how I shoot even the subconscious stuff that I do and sort of have a little bit of an analysis of that and try to bottle it up for my students so that they can replicate it.
That's really great. That's really good to know. And you're absolutely spot on. The fuzziness doesn't really help anybody, right?
Well, it does in a way because it keeps those, you know, famous photographers sort of on a pedestal. They look like geniuses. So it does help them in a way. But I think it's, what I get a kick out of is when I see one of my students go from, you know, mediocre images to like really stunning stuff that I wish I had shot myself. That's when I really feel, you know, like I'm making a difference.
You That's know, awesome. Well, the layering you've got, you know, again, you've got several photographs going on at once in different layers, which is really powerful. It gives a lot of dimension.
Thank you. Yeah. So this picture is also one of the early ones from that Venice project. And it was actually, it won, I think it was one of the finalists for National Geographic Traveler Photographer of the Year Award. It was the only black and white. In the, they had like 11 pictures, and that was the only, that was in 2016. And so this is also at Venice Beach, which is, you know, my favorite shooting spot here. And you're right. Layered geometry. Yeah. You know, this is textbook Cartier-Bresson.
Cartier-Bresson, you know, loves geometry, loves layers.
Not by accident. I mean, you know, I study his work and I love, you know, he's been such an inspiration, obviously. Yeah. But yeah, these images, I mean, they require a little bit of luck, obviously. In this case, I was not even looking through the viewfinder because I don't know if you can see in the background, there's that fence around this gym. This is an outdoor gym that's very, and so there's that rusty fence that has very tight, you know, bars around it. And I really needed the low angle to capture the juxtaposition of the two bodybuilders. And I couldn't get it behind that fence because by lowering the camera, I had the bars of the fence in front of me. So I had to kind of hunch over the fence, like, and put the camera down, which meant I couldn't look through the viewfinder, and I had to kind of aim the best I could while sort of timing the moment to get this result. So I took a couple of shots, and luckily one of them worked out, and it was at the peak moment. And so,
what was your lens? Do you remember?
So that's, and that's a great question, because that's the part. It's impossible to do this kind of stuff with a zoom or with, you know, if you constantly change lenses. I shoot only with a 35 millimeter prime, which means I really know, I have sort of engraved in my head exactly the angle that I get from it and what distance gets me, you know, how much is in the frame and how the frame is going to look like. So that meant in this picture, I didn't have to look through the viewfinder to really have a sense of what that was going to look like, because I only use the 35 on that camera.
So you only, that's it. You shoot with 35. That's it.
35 is all I use. I have a 50 that I use maybe, I don't know, 1% of the time. I don't even know why I have it anymore.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, the 35 is the only lens. And the benefit, you know, a lot of people think of that as a something detrimental, that, you know, I'm limited because I only have a 35. So there's only, you know, I can only do certain things. For me, it's actually a benefit because I have, you know, I have the luxury of not even having to look through the viewfinder a lot of times.
Agreed.
To take, and so that, which is not something you can do if you constantly change focal lengths.
You know, and the other point of it is, you know, if you have all these variables, we're getting back to your computer science. If there's all these variables, you really can't dial in on where you want to go. So if you eliminate variables, all of a sudden you've got a pattern that you can follow in your own photography that keeps working.
Yeah, that is spot on. That's the other thing is, to me, when you first asked me what drives me, it's the moment. And so I try to get everything out of the way that gets me to that moment. Yeah. So I shoot manual. Another thing that people might consider a limitation is manual focusing. And I shoot manual focus because it gets one more thing out of the equation. I can pre-focus and then forget about focusing. I don't have to worry about whether, you know, somebody will pass in front of the camera and the autofocus will pick up that person, or I know exactly what the focus is going to do, and that's out of the way. And then I shoot aperture priority. So once I select the depth of field that I want, which is most of the time around 8, 5, 6, or 8.
Okay.
I don't have to worry about that either. That's out of the way.
Boom.
And because it's aperture priority, I don't have to select the speed. I actually put ISO on auto ISO.
Wow.
So you kind of nailed it. Yeah. I get rid of all those different parameters that you normally have to worry about and that can distract you from the moment. So, you know, focusing, aperture, all these decisions go away. Lens, you know, what lens should I use? Well, how should I zoom it? That all that stuff is gone away once you distill it to just the basics.
You're preaching from the same book that I always, you know, it's like, unfortunately, I think it's one of the biggest traps of photography is adding numerous variables. What camera, what lens, what zoom, what this, what, you know, right. It would be like if you were going into your kitchen every day and you had a completely new set of knives and refrigerators moved and.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's exactly
your stove
right.
is different, a different place, you know, forget about it.
Absolutely.
Let's see a couple more. And then we're going to, I really want to walk through your workflow. I'm so excited about that. I love this image. I love this image. This is just, so much going on here. Tell me what's happening.
So, yes, this is one of my favorite ones of that Venice Beach series as well. I think it's the last one of that series that I selected for the show. But this is where my street photography sometimes kind of delves into documentary mode. And that's what I love doing, is going in between the two, because street really can get you into documentary if you just, you know, if you dig enough and if you make enough of a contact with the subject. So this group of hippies, essentially, who were, some of them are homeless, living on the beach in Venice Beach. Others were just passing through in this van. And I befriended them. They were singing on the boardwalk one day in the rain. They were the only ones there. And I took a couple photos of them singing, one of which is also in the book. and send them the photo. You know, I always offer to share it. That's a big, you know, that really gets me very far in terms of people letting me shoot. And they were thrilled with this photo. They were playing music and they were like, oh, that could be our next album cover, which, you know, I thought that was very, very cute. I followed up with them. So I got their contact info to be able to send them the picture, but then I followed up with them and said, is it okay if I come back and follow you guys around tomorrow? Because I didn't know, you know, these guys are only there for a few days usually, and then they leave. So anyway, the next day I came back, and we ended up back in their van, and I ended up, you know, being kind of the fly on the wall in that crazy van where, you know, they were passing, you know, joints around and just doing what they do. And there were some interesting layered scenes like this with the hand up there for, you know, from the top.
I love that hand. That's the killer
joint. And they were, you know, still holding a cigarette, and the animal pants on the left with the skateboard sticking out. There's even a guitar handle at the top left, and this photo actually I printed it in 3 feet by 5 feet in one of my exhibits, and I was able to finally read like the stuff on the books in the back. I mean, there's so much. There's a poem on that leaflet on the door, on the window. There's just so much there. The badges on the guy. So anyway, that I discovered things about my own photograph when it was printed this big, which is always thrilling.
Hey, you know what I love about it? I love a lot of things about it, but I feel like I'm right there, you know, which is what capturing the moment is all about. So much so that I feel like I can smell what that inside of that van smells like. But I'm not an outside observer. I'm in the moment with you, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I think, I mean, part of this is the moment, but a lot of it, I think, is also that focal length, you know, to go back to that lens. Yeah. I don't want to be a gearhead about it because I will have that one lens and that's all I use. And I think there's really a great thing about just using very little equipment. Personally, I just use one camera and one lens and that's it. Mm. But the wide angle, you know, whether you choose a 28 or a 35, whatever your angle is, you know, once you find it, and for me, that's the 35, you can really get, as long as it's a wide angle, you can get that sort of, and you get close enough, you can get that intimacy that you sense in this photo.
I think that's the secret sauce right there, Dotun. It's the 35 wide angle, but getting up close gives you that intimate feeling.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. Some people get it with a 28, you know, some people prefer a 50. I really, you know, when people start my street class, they come from, you know, from using zooms or telephotos sometimes. And my first, you know, the first thing I try to do is to like anchor them to, here's, you know, street photography in my book anyway, cannot be done with a telephoto. You have to get close. You have to get, you know, as uncomfortable as it feels. And, you know, I teach them all about, like, you know, getting close to strangers and approaching strangers, photographing strangers and getting comfortable with that. But there's no substitute. You can't be on the other side of the street with a 200 millimeter lens and hope to get something that's going to feel like this.
Exactly. You know, no way. Let's look at one more and then dive into your processing.
Sure. So this is from Cuba.
This is color.
Yeah, I know, right? So this is a big departure. So when I got to Cuba, I actually had, this is one of the rare times that I had two cameras. And one was my monochrome that I was finishing up my Venice Beach series with. And I had been so tempted that I got at the time it was the Leica 240, the M240, which is the, you know, their color version. And I was shooting both, and I brought both with me to Cuba, and not knowing exactly what to expect because I had never been before. And as soon as I got to the airport, I saw so much color just coming at me from everywhere.
Exactly.
I just decided I could not shoot the monochrome there, so I shot that entire series in color.
I love this image, and again, boom, layers. I mean, how you timed it where your guy driving is turning his head while the girl is looking back. I mean, that's brilliant. And we see him in the rearview mirror too. That's right. Incredible.
So some of these photos, you know, some of them that we saw were totally just, you know, spur of the moment, just reacting to what I was seeing. In this case, there was some pre-visualization involved. This is a picture I kind of had in my head. I wasn't sure what was going to be in that background layer. And actually, there's a third layer. If you can see through the windshield of the other car, you can see the there's a light tower. The fort at the that's like a famous Cuban Havana landmark. But my goal with this, you know, I hired this guy to drive me around, and you know, they have those old cars that, and I picked the car because I liked the dash and I figured that would look good in a photo. And I liked that he was wearing a hat and everything. So part of it was, you know, I kind of set the scene that way because that I was looking for this kind of shot. But then I wasn't sure what was going to be in my second layer. And I actually didn't get anything. Like it was about to be the end of the ride. He was actually bringing me back to the parking lot. And I was kind of, you know, I was like, oh my God, I paid all this money to like, and I have nothing. And then he saw one of his buddies in his rearview mirror, and he started like honking. And as the guy was passing him, he kept honking. And so I guess the passengers of that other car must have wondered like, what is going on? And then, so that's when she turned around and was like, oh my God. So I have like three or four shots as the car, you know, passed ours. And so this is my favorite, but I had pre-visualized, I wanted him in the rearview mirror. And so I knew what I was doing there. I just didn't know what moment I was going to get in that second layer. And then this moment happened. And so it was, you know, half preparation and half luck, I would say. And
fantastic. Well, luck favors the prepared photographer, is what Ansel Adams said. So you were prepared. All right, I love it. I want to find out about your, I want to know the secrets of your processing. So let's switch into that. Sure. Is this the image we're going to look at?
So let me, so if we're processing, I prepared something else.
Yeah. And there we go. Okay. So you're going to walk us through your workflow.
Absolutely. So yeah, so this is another image from Venice, from a muscle beach contest. A bodybuilding contest. And this guy was dressed up as Batman, which I had never seen in a bodybuilding contest. I shot this contest maybe four times. Wow. And you know, it's rare to see those characters, but when they pop up, you're like, I'm sticking with this guy the whole time and see what I can get. And I didn't really envision this, you know, him waiting for the bathroom, which was bound to happen at some point because it's like a day long contest.
Right.
But when I saw him headed there, I was like, oh my God, there's a picture there. But I need to have all these elements in it to make sure people understand that he's going to the bathroom. So I have the little bathroom sign. Like I was very careful about my framing and everything. But anyway, so we're going to jump into the processing of this. This is an image I really like it in color. I could process it in color as much as, you know, in black and white. But today we're going to just watch the black and white version. So typically the first thing I do when I look at a picture like this is to look at the exposure. Before I even go into Nick Silver Effects, into the plugin, I look at the exposure in Lightroom and I look at my histogram, and does it look like it's covering, you know, it's you know, there's nothing. So I'm going to go into develop mode, and in develop mode, I'm getting my histogram and I can hit those little triangles. Yeah. A lot of people don't see those triangles, but what they do is they tell you if there's anything that's underexposed or overexposed. So here you can see there's a little bit of a blue area here. Uh-huh. That means this is completely lost in the blacks. And I don't see any red on here, which means nothing's overexposed.
Yeah.
So this, I mean, I don't really mind losing blacks like under that trailer right here.
Exactly.
So I'm fine with that. And there's nothing overexposed. So in this particular case, I don't really need to adjust the exposure before going to Silver Effects. But if often I do, especially with the monochrome, I underexpose images on purpose. So in Lightroom, I would bring them back slightly so that I have a proper histogram before going into Nick. That's just, you know, part of my process. I just wanted to point that out here before we go in there. So here I would just jump right into Silver Effects. And all right. This will momentarily open. So it's preparing the file for editing.
I mean, one of the things I love about working with the Nick Collection is that you can just hit that edit in and you switch right over from Lightroom or Photoshop into the collection.
Yeah, no, that's super handy. It is. And with the latest version of the Nick Collection, they added something that it's funny because I had a meeting with them about a year ago, and they asked me not even a year ago, actually, it was like 9 months ago. They asked me, what is my number one thing I would want from the next version of Nick? And I told them, I would love to go back into an image that I've already processed with Nick and change things. Totally. And they added it, I was blown away that they added it so fast. And so here you see that little checkbox at the bottom right. So for all the people who have the older version or are still using a free version of Nick, totally worth upgrading for that one. Sure, they've added a lot. It's a lot more stable. They've added a lot of other things. But this is a great feature because once you leave the picture, you can always go back to it and improve it if you see anything else that you've missed.
So true. Very important.
So the way I start here is I've got a little selection of favorites, because if you go into Nick, there's like 48 presets and it can be a little overwhelming, and a lot of them don't look good with the particular image that you're processing. So I've kind of, starred a few of their presets. So I'm just going to, and what I do is when I look at a picture for the first time, when I bring into Nick, at first you just see there's no filter to it when you first look at it. Yeah. And then you can put a preset, you can look, pre-visualize different presets. So that's what I do is I've pre-visualized my image with the presets and decide which one, not just to use as a preset, but to use as a starting point. Mm-hmm. Here I've got the full dynamic one, what they call fine art process, wet rocks, full contrast and structure, and another one that I called Dotan's modified T-Max 400, which is just something I used for one of the projects. I really like that first one. I think that's the one that works best.
Yeah.
Just out of the box. So I'm going to stick with that one. And once I pick it, there's no need to have that real estate taken up by the presets. I can just close that preset slider and just regain that whole real estate, have more space for my picture.
Cool.
And then I focus on the right-hand side adjustments. So a lot of people, when you first go into Nick, you find all these things are closed, like this. And I mean, the whole thing is just looks like a very short set of tools, but you really need to expand all these things to see what you're doing. So I prefer, and once you've expanded them, the great thing is once you go back in, when you go back into Nick, they'll stay the way that you left them. So I like them all spread out like that, and I don't mind scrolling to find them. So that's just personal preference, but that way I can see everything that's at my disposal.
Yeah.
The first thing I do when I get to this point is look at they have this tonality protection thing, which can be helpful in some pictures, but in a lot of cases, it sort of muddies what you do because it sort of kind of keeps you safe in terms of preserving shadows and preserving highlights.
Okay.
I want as high a contrast as I can. I really want blacks and I want to go all the way into the whites, and I want an image that's going to have as much of a tonality range as possible. So I'm going to get rid of their shadow protection and their highlight protection. And then whatever changes I make, I'm really going to see the effect of that as opposed to having a muted effect.
Okay.
So that's the first thing, as I bring those things. And I might decide to bring them back if I decide that I need them, but at first I just take them down.
Okay.
again, personal workflow preference that I kind of figured out over time. Then what I do is I look at different parts of the image and what exactly do I want to say with this image? And is there anything that is kind of getting in the way of my storytelling? So here, in this case, there's a couple of things I can see just right off the bat. I want to just put a little more emphasis maybe on this guy coming out of the bathroom because he's part of the story and I want him to pop.
Yeah.
So for that, I might add a control point. So this is where we go into local adjustments. And a lot of people who use those, I actually got a question last time from that I did a demo like this, where often people don't know that there's more than those three sliders that you can use in local adjustments. There's that tiny little triangle of a icon here that a lot of people miss. And once you click it, it opens four more adjustments that you have. And one of them I use a lot, which is the amplify whites, because I find it a lot more natural than just boosting the brightness. So it's just more subtle.
Look at that.
So I can just slightly move that. And I want to make sure I just got him because I don't want to brighten the whole area. I just want to brighten him. And another cool trick that I've learned is that once you've got a control point that you like the effect of, you can duplicate it. So if you hit on Mac, it's the Option key. And you... I forget what it is on PC. I'm sure the PC users will know what the equivalent is, but you can then keep your key pressed while you move that point and move it to another area so that you can brighten another part of the body here in the same way, consistent with the top. So that's cool. That's one. That's another thing. One great processing tip that I would give is that people's eyes, when they look at your image, the eyes tend to go to the bright areas.
Yeah.
And it can be great if your subject is brighter than the rest, but and which is great here because Batman is like, he's the hero of this picture, obviously. Yeah. Being a hero by nature, but he's surrounded with white space, which is perfect for drawing attention. There's a great contrast because he's all in black and surrounded with white space, which is perfect, except that the white space is going into the corners and I don't want my eye to go into the corners too much.
Right.
So I'm going to drop another point here, another control point in the corner and have a little bit of sort of a vignetting effect by bringing down the brightness slightly. And I might want to make it very diffuse and broad. So I'm going to do that. And these are very subtle things, but once you can compare the before and after.
Oh yeah.
This is the unprocessed, you probably would get this if you just, as you mentioned earlier, if you just pulled the saturation down.
Yeah.
And then this is with Nick with the preset, but then adding some of the stuff we're doing. The other bright spots, there's like a bright spot right at the bottom here on this guy's lower back. And I want to take that down a little bit because it's distracting. When you have bright spots at the edges of your pictures, that's like a recipe for disaster because that means the eye of the viewer is going to go into those areas and you want the eye to stay in the picture.
You're pulling them right out of the photo when you do that, when you leave that, rather than keeping them in. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So there's another bright spot here at the bottom. I might just do that a little bit, bring that down a tiny bit. There's a bright spot on those stairs here. So I'm going to just selectively just bring those make a little bit of a difference. This guy is bright, but I don't mind it too much because he's one of the characters and he's huge and he can, he adds, something and with his speedo and everything, there's a little, I want him to be an important part of the picture. So I'm not going to bring him back too much. there are reflections on here that are not necessarily helping the picture. I mean, they could be in another context, but they're not in this context. So I'm going to maybe bring them down and bring down the structure as well, so that they kind of disappear and fade into the background more.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, in this picture, it's subtle little things like that. And because the eye is less worried about these reflections, it's more drawn to that bathroom sign, which is where I want the eye to go.
Yeah.
I might even, there's a shadow already. Like, so what I like is each character in this picture is isolated in its own frame, if you will. So the one is in the frame of the door. The big guy in the middle is framed by this shadow in the back of the door. So I might want to bring even that shadow down further, so he's even more of a contrast. And one tip also with silver effects that works great is if you start putting those control points, especially for darkening around the screen, around the image, things will get darker even that you didn't intend to get darker. So dropping a neutral control point, like I'm going to do right by the Batman's face, you'll see the background behind Batman become much more, much brighter. Well, not much, but a little bit brighter in this case. But I'm going to drop a couple of control points just to bring, what it does is it just brings that area back to normal or maybe slightly brighter. And that way Batman really pops a lot more. There's one last thing that I would do with this picture. I mean, I'm sure I could spend an hour and just find nitpick more things, but the wall here is a little bit distracting because there's a lot of structure and detail in the wall, and that's not what I want people to look at.
Yeah.
So those control points that I dropped that have other, either brightness reduced and things like that, I'm also going to reduce the structure all the way down to zero. Which, will still leave a lot of structure, but it will help get rid of that, that distracting element of the kind of the grit of that wall.
Let's see the before and after again.
Yeah. So.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
This might be a little strong of a brightness reduction. I'm going to bring that back a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you go from a picture where it's, you could probably read it if
you read
the story, but then you get to like, okay, it's not in your face. You really have the story clear. Yeah. This guy coming out of the bathroom, Batman's waiting, there's the bathroom sign. Everything is much more pleasant in terms of tonalities. And so one very powerful slider, I'll just finish with that for this photo, is the soft contrast.
Oh, yeah.
Which I want to be very careful about. If I take it all the way to here, it's just too much and not natural looking. If I take it all the way down, it's a mess as well. And you have to very carefully use it to find just the right balance. And I think in this case, we had it when we started.
I always use the analogy that these sliders are like cooking. If you want a little tiny bit of chili in your sauce, don't dump it all in, just a couple of flakes maybe.
Right. You can always add more. And I guess the beauty of this is, unlike cooking, you can add spice and then remove it.
Exactly. That's the nice thing.
So it's easier that way. So once I'm happy with it, in this new version, again, I have this checkbox and it says, save and edit later. For it does result in larger files, but you don't do this with every single one of your photos.
Right.
So I'm okay having larger files for the photos that I process with this. Oh, one last thing. Sorry, there's always one more thing.
Sure, always.
I like to check the zone system. They give you that zone system where you can see... and you can check whether you have things in every single zone. In this case, I see that I'm actually missing my zone zero. I don't see anything popping up when I hit zero. So I might want to darken the shadows just a little bit from here. And then, now I have too much in the shadow. So I just kind of look at what gets me into zone zero, just so I get maximum contrast. Okay, I like this. And then same for zone 10. Those are really the two that I worry about the most. I want maximum contrast. And I'm not, see, I have a little bit on the shoulder of the big guy when it comes to zone 9, but not 10. So yeah. I might take my highlights and pull them a little bit just so I can step into that zone 10 and get at least a tiny bit in zone 10.
I love that. I mean, for you guys who haven't read Ansel Adams, he was the master of the zone system, getting a pure white and a pure black in every image. Really makes it pop. So that's a very cool feature.
So I'm going to save it. I mean, this is an image. I see still things that I would correct, like there's too much of a bright spot on the shoulder and so on. I'm going to save it for the purpose of this presentation. But I think what I wanted to go through, it wasn't about, you know, processing this picture. It was more about showing you different things that can be done with silver effects. And I think we've made that point. So now you have the color.
Yeah.
The original color version, and now this is the black and white silver effects.
Awesome.
Best.
Let's dive into a few questions. One that came up a moment ago is the two. So you didn't try to get rid of it on the top left corner.
The two. Yeah. This is a great question. So this is one where the cropping. So you could just argue, hey, you know, I don't need to keep the original, aspect ratio and just, you know, just clip it out slightly. And I'm not, you know, I'm slightly at a different aspect ratio, but that's okay. You know, that's a purely an artistic decision. Different people feel different way about this. I'm personally, I'm okay with my Venice series. I was very, loose about that. And I didn't really care. Some photos were in the book cropped square. Others were, I try to stick to like three different aspect ratios that I followed. So I didn't get out of those three, but I did, you know, some I cropped square, some I cropped like this, and others I just left as the original aspect ratio. Yeah. That's one way. You can also crop with the same aspect ratio, but in that case, in this picture, I don't want the top to get too close to the head of the guy coming out of the bathroom.
Right.
Because I like that frame. I want to keep that whole door frame. I don't want to crop the hands of the guy, of the big guy.
Yeah.
You know? So it's a really tricky one to crop with the original aspect ratio. One way we could have darkened that two a little bit, but then it, you know, very quickly becomes a little unnatural because you see the two is darkened, but not the bathroom sign, and it gets a little iffy there. I think in this case, it's a case where I would just take a little bit of freedom to bring just the left side, I mean the right side of the image in a little bit as a, you know, different, slightly different aspect ratio, and just hope it doesn't get noticed.
Would you consider using Lightroom and hiding it, you know, going in with an adjustment layer or with the, and just, you know, using the spot
you
removal?
Could, I mean, yeah, or you can do, so there's this tool, what is it called? Sorry, the, God, my
spot removal. Yeah,
the graduated filter.
Oh, okay.
So you can use the graduated filter in this case because it's at the edge. And you bring in this graduated filter. If you hit the shift key while you do that, it stays straight as opposed to kind of moving around like that.
Yeah.
And once you have that, you can bring the exposure down. Right. So it will just like this. And it's gradual, so it doesn't look too. So that's one way. But you're right that the corner of an image are really, really important. And you want to make sure that you've carefully thought about things that are on the corners and whether you want them to be as noticeable as they are.
Yeah. Cool. Well, let's see if we have any other questions. So that was one about using the healing brush rather than cropping. We handled that. We have a hello from Israel, by the way.
Shalom.
Cool. And Jared, did you see some other ones that we should pick up?
We have one other question. We had several questions, but you already answered them. They asked them, and then a couple minutes later, you would answer them. We have one from earlier in the show, though, about getting access for doing intimate documentary work. And specifically, they were wondering about, you know, the whole idea of getting access and, you know, just recording what you're seeing and not getting caught up necessarily in your own thought process. I think that's where they're kind of going with it.
Okay. So the last my last book that's actually coming out on September 1st, it's already been released in terms of in Europe. And then I have a Kickstarter and I already shipped the copies for that. The book is available on my website. It's called Nowhere to Go But Everywhere. It's a documentary on a family that lives in a school bus and that I met in Venice. Yeah. And so this is one of the first images I made with them. And my project at the time was to document a whole bunch of different people living in vehicles, because that's really become a thing in LA. And it's really hard to know. Some of these people are, you know, downright homeless, and this is the last, you know, place that they have. They've lost their home, they've lost their apartment, and they live in their car or in their van or in their RV. But it also goes all the way to people who do this as a life choice and everything in between. So I was very curious to kind of document different people's lives that are in those different situations. And I bumped into this family who I ended up making the whole book about. I still want to pursue the project beyond that family, but the work with them was so, I don't know, inspiring, and there's so many different layers to their story that my publisher and I felt compelled to just do a book just about them. Mm-hmm. So to answer the question about the documentary aspect, it's I think you have to do something that you're passionate about, that you really feel strongly about yourself. That's a subject that grabs you. It can't be something that just you feel is like sensational or will please people or is cool right now because it's in the news. It has to be something that you feel, you know, that's close to your heart. Otherwise it's not going to feel heartfelt, and I don't think it's worth pursuing. Those are things that also take a long time. So in this case of this family, it was actually relatively short because they were only in LA for about 10 months. And I shot for the whole 10 months with them on and off. Obviously I wasn't there every day, but because these projects are so long, if you're not having fun doing them and if you're not feeling compelled, you know, for personal reasons to do them, you're going to lose interest. I mean, it's really hard to stay with a project that long. And 10 months is kind of a minimum. You know, it's not worth doing if you're not going to really enjoy the process and feel like it's a meaningful thing for you to do. So that, you know, that's part of it. And I think when you go into something in a very heartfelt way, the subject of the documentary feels it, and it's something you really have to be very natural and candid about, and that whole relationship gets built on, you know, trust and faith in each other and so on. And so I think to the extent you're going at it with this perspective and this, you know, kind of disposition, I think you end up with great results, because the subjects, you know, have enough trust in you to let you, you know, into those intimate moments.
Yeah.
So that's what happened in this case. And this is also why I stuck with this one family, because I really had great access, and they were just happy to have me there, and we had a great relationship. We still do.
Again, there's your 35 millimeter lens, the intimate feeling, and no one's distracted by you. They're just carrying on, and that's fantastic. We're getting this inside view here. Very intimate.
Right. This is another one of them. Wow. A little messier, but they're all there.
Wow.
They're all in there.
Amazing shot that is.
And they're
Totem, we're going to have you back. We have so much more to cover. You're going to be coming back on this show, so you might as well be prepared for it.
All right. Whenever you want, Mark, I'm always ready. Okay. I'm always pleased to be on your show.
Well, listen, this has been fantastic. Are there any final points you'd like to leave viewers with, either in terms of, you know, documentary or converting to black and white or both?
I think, you know, we've talked a lot about a lot of the things. I actually do teach in my class, so I think you had that. If anything, I would just go through, you know, give context, because I've been talking about a couple of different books and cameras and things, and so I'm just going to quickly slide through a couple of things. So this is what the Venice book looks like. This was published 2 years ago, and this is coming out in September, but it's already available on my website. And It's by the same publisher, by the way. I've been working with Kara Verlag, who's a fantastic German publisher. They're real craftspeople where they know the bookmaking process, and I've learned so much from them. And each book is really more than a book. They design books so that they're really objects of art. And I cherish these books, and I buy other books from them as well, from other photographers that I love, and they really have a way to make beautiful, beautiful books that are more than just books.
Fantastic.
This is what I shoot with, and just that this is 50 actually that's shown on there, but I shoot it with a 35, and this is my my street photography class, and I think you've already shared the coupon and everything, but I just launched this in June. I'm adding modules to it. There's going to be 5 modules total. Each module, this is strictly about street photography, by the way, so this is not about photography in general. You kind of have to come to it with an understanding of photography and, right. and technique, but this teaches you really how to find moments in the street, how to capture them, and with really a methodology behind it, not just you go and you see what happens and try to get it. I'm really into providing people with a roadmap to getting those results.
Beautiful. We have all the links in there. We'll definitely have them in the description. Doten, thanks again. This has been wonderful. Thanks. I learned a lot myself. I'm gonna try some of those new tools that you showed me and Nick. That's fantastic.
I'm so glad. Thank
we'll have you back again for
sure. I'm a big fan of yours.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks for joining us today on Advancing Your Photography. If there's anything you wanted to see from today's episode, you can find the video version of this show on our YouTube channel, Advancing Your Photography. You can also find the show notes on our website, silverstudios.com/podcast. Please rate and leave a review, subscribe, and be sure to share with your friends. And until next time, remember to get out and capture your own images of life.